can begin. All right. So this is class 11 of Genjo Koan. I'm calling it Understanding How Much We Don't Know. So we've been going through this text by Dogen. Dogen was a Zen master in the 1200s. And this is the Zen recitation that we read tonight. It's a relatively short text, just a few pages long, but it's very, very rich. So we've been studying it for quite a while now. And we have, I think after this, like two more classes, two or three, but we're gonna be wrapping it up because, as you get to the later parts of it, there's larger chunks that stick together in a common theme. So that's why it took me so long to work through the kanji today, because this is a long passage and the next couple ones are too. But it's all of a theme. So let's see. I know there's a couple folks here tonight who are new to this. So let me think if there's any way to introduce this. Well, in general, I would say, so Genjo Koan, one translation is actualization of reality. One of our Sangha members suggested, I think it was Andrew, closing the gap. It's always gonna stick in my mind as the appropriate name for Genjo Koan, because it's pointing us toward this kind of apparently dualistic experience we have in life where, there's a mundane reality, there's the difficulties and challenges of life, there's our aspirations as people in our spiritual practice, our family relationships, our moral behavior, and it kind of seems like an uphill slog sometimes, that aspect of our work. But Zen is also always pointing us toward the reality of this moment is that we have everything we need. Everything is luminous and precious just as it is. And we can awaken to that at any time. There's no, like the last passage we talked about was how just as the moon reflected in a drop of dew, the whole moon can be reflected in the drop of dew. There's a way that this, this universal truth that our hearts long for is reflected even in our limited person. It's not, our limited person doesn't obstruct it or limit it. It's just, the nature of enlightenment or waking up to reality, to liberation is it's not what we think it is. Our little minds, we have assumptions about it. So earlier on in Genjo Koan, he talks about how Buddhas greatly enlighten delusion, and sentient beings, meaning ordinary beings who are still caught up in the angst of being alive, ordinary beings are greatly deluded about enlightenment. So in a way, this whole text is trying to clarify for us what being awake really means. So tonight's passage is, which I will read, is pointing toward the limits of our perception and how really waking up to the reality of those limits actually is enlightenment. You would think like somehow enlightenment would entail surpassing those limits or becoming somehow omniscient or tapping into some kind of big ultimate truth. But actually, and next week's section, I think, is perhaps my favorite. It's about the fish and the birds and the and fully practicing this practice and whatever. But that's really a celebration, which we will get to, of how all we have to do is just be this being, just fully be this self right here, right now, with its limited perceptions, limited insight. And if we're fully there, we have all of it. So to share this text, so the translation that we chant is by Shohaku Okumura, and that's on page 49 in our chant book and was also shared in the chat for a recitation. However, I'm going to be offering you a different translation. And it looks like I need to be made a co-host once again so I can share my screen. We were once co-hosts, but then we dropped off the meeting. Thank you. And so this is, I'm not going to go through it in a great detail, but just widening my little Zoom screen here so I can see more of you. So I kind of made my own translation. So we'll go through the, oh, here, handouts, handouts in the Zendo. Forgot about that part. Physical handouts, look at that. So I'm gonna go through it line by line, just kind of sharing with you what my translation is. So Dogen says,
excuse me, Daniel.
Yeah.
They've shown up in the chat for a link.
Oh, right. Would you like a PDF or a Google Doc?
Yes, please.
All right, to everyone, here's the PDF. Okay. All right. And there are, if you're curious about in the future, I have put links to these little kanji translation things on the Genjo Koan page on the website. So each week, you know, there's a little link to the document I made. So Dogen says, when body-mind, so body-mind is Shinjin, and that's often how he refers to us, body-mind. When body-mind is not yet, so if they're like intimately tied together, not separate. When body-mind is not yet fully practicing in Dharma. So I like to just try to do this like, I mean, I don't know that much. I really don't know that much about Japanese. The translations I get word for word here, I'm borrowing from someone else. So I'm kind of making it up, but I try to discard what I see as extra interpretation. So literally, body, mind in Dharma, not yet. San is realize or practice. And Bo is satiated or full persistently to the utmost. And then is not when. So you got to rearrange things a little bit. But so when body mind is not yet fully, has not yet fully realized, but then there's in the Dharma as well. So I like the practice, you're realizing in that are practicing in Dharma. And then I didn't insert the translation line, or I somehow got rid of it. Okay. The next line, sorry. One thing, I copied and pasted this into my class document and actually just stole it. One thinks the Dharma is already sufficient. Dharma already is sufficient, we think. So when body mind is not yet, we haven't really gotten it yet, we think, I don't know, there's a sense in which we think what we see is what we get. You know, there's not too much to it. All right. You know, we always understand, yeah, there's more I can learn, but it's just kind of more of the same, right? It's not like, you know, we get it. We think we get it. Before we get the Dharma, we think we get it. Yeah, maybe not when you're a total beginner, but actually we envy beginner's mind, right? When a total beginner comes in and they're like, I don't know anything about this. That's actually a wonderful attitude, which then the longer you practice, the less you have that attitude. So when we don't fully get the Dharma, we think it's already sufficient. When body mind is completely sufficient in Dharma, one thinks the person is not sufficient. So interestingly, it doesn't say we think the body mind is insufficient. We think the person is insufficient or is not sufficient. So Dharma, if body mind in complete sufficient, if that is the case, then person, we think the person is not sufficient. Hitu kata, just a person.
So are you distinguishing between body, mind, and person in that sentence?
It looks like he is. He uses different terms.
Okay.
And I would say that that person points more toward our sense of ourselves in the world, whereas body, mind is a more basic, like that's our basic unit of function as a living being. It doesn't have to have any of the person stuff attached to it. So, I mean, but it's a good thing to explore. Like, why does he, what's the difference there? What's the difference between body, mind, and person? So he's going to explain this. The rest of this is kind of a metaphor for explaining what he means. So he says, for example, when riding in a ship when riding in a ship without mountains, so like you can't see the mountains anymore, and you go out into the center of the sea, you go out in the middle of the ocean, and you're looking in the four directions, you know, four cardinal directions and all in between, you see only a circle. You just see a circle of water. And there's no other, I like that, there is no visibility of a different aspect. So this is really clunky English. It's not pretty English, but it's like, I feel like it gets at the juice of this. So Shohaku Okamura says, when we sail a boat into the ocean beyond sight of land and our eyes scan the horizon in the four directions, it simply looks like a circle. No other shape appears. But in the Japanese there, you can see Koto Naru is different. If you're curious at all, when you see an O and a U, that's a way of writing a long O. So really it could be an O with a line above it. It's not U, an U sound, it's an O sound. Anyway, so that's state, condition, or aspect. Mira U is visible or C, and it says something like it's emphatic. And this is a translation that I have from another source. And I don't know what exactly that means, but I thought I'd stick it in there. And then Koto supposedly makes miru yu into a gerund, into a noun, and then does not exist. So that's why I turned it into visibility as a noun. There is no visibility of a different aspect. Get the point. However, this great ocean is not round or square. So that is pretty straightforward. This great sea, round circle is not, square is not.
Hey, Damya.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you need to scroll down a little. Yeah, thank you.
Yep, sorry. Thanks for that reminder. Okay, there's the boat. Um, So then the Japanese is remaining, or other than this, ocean virtue cannot exhaust. It's inexpressible that you cannot exhaust is. So I translated as one cannot exhaust the ocean's other virtues. So he's saying, you know, which we know because of our intellectual knowledge, right? We see the circle of the ocean, and yet we know the ocean has many other characteristics that aren't evident to our perceptions at the moment. And those characteristics, those virtues, and it really is virtue, he says, are you cannot exhaust them. So then it goes on to say, it's like a palace, it's like a jeweled necklace. And Shohaku Okumura helps us out with those images, because he said, to a fish, it looks like a palace. So he inserts those words so we understand what these references are. And to a heavenly being, a jeweled necklace. But I like to think of also, like, you know, if you look at the ocean from space, it looks, you know, very different. That might look like a jeweled necklace. So then, just one's eyes reach, and then reach, Oyobu Tokoro is kind of reach a place. That has been made into a noun. And then briefly for a while, round circle visible sea only is. So I like to say briefly seeing a circle is only the reach of one's eye. So I like how that even says briefly, right? Only at this moment is this how we're perceiving the ocean. And for a moment, it looks like a circle, and that's how our eye can reach, how our eye can perceive. And it goes on to say the myriad dharmas are also like this. The myriad dharmas, meaning dharma, mean a word for thing, essentially. So all things, all the many things are also like this. And then dust center, standard beyond, many state of affairs. And then tie is like belt or zone. And one of my translations said that in this context, it means assume. And then although. So I translate that as in the dusty world, and the dusty world is shorthand for, you know, the mundane world that we live in. And then kakugai means exceptional. So if you can imagine in this dusty world, and then whatever exceptional realms may exist, and I think one assumes many situations. So that belt or zone, you could see, it's like your constraint, your mentally, you know, constraint. You're creating a concept. So you assume many situations, but this one was a tough one to try to make some English out of. But realize and learn and know. So ganriki is eye power, or I mean that's what Shohaku Okumura translates it as, the eye of study and practice. But one of my translations says it does mean insight. So that makes sense, you know, the eye of study and practice, your eye power, your insight, your ability to perceive and understand, which you might have expanded through practice, but there's still a limit to it. So it reaches only, and then sea grasp, understand grass. There's a lot of understand grasps and seas, and I don't know how to parse them all up, but the way that I wanted to translate that was, in the dusty world and beyond, one assumes many situations. Understanding is realizing one's insight reaches only so far. So Shohaku Okumura says, Within the dusty world and beyond, there are innumerable aspects and characteristics. We only see or grasp as far as the power of our eye of study and practice can see. Understanding is realizing one's insight reaches only so far. And then myriad dharmas, and then their family or house, style or way. So a family way or a family wind is, you know, the traditions or style of a family, of a lineage, you know, of tradition like Buddhism. So it's like the way that, to know that the way that things function. So the myriad dharmas family way, if you want to understand it, in order to understand it, so there's square circle sea besides and remains ocean virtue, mountain virtue, great. Limit, no, without limit. So if you want to understand the family way of myriad dharmas, see the virtues of oceans and mountains besides square or circle are great without limit. And one should know there are worlds in the four directions. So Shohaku Okamura says, no, there are many worlds in the four directions. I don't see any many in there, but you know, I could understand in translating, it seems to be implied, there are worlds in the four directions. Kind of implies many worlds, right? And then finally, and one should know, it is not only one's surroundings which are like this, but also directly below and a single drop of water. So again, Shohaku Okamura has inserted some prepositions and stuff to make it more readable, but one should know that it's not only one's surroundings which are like this. So kata water is beside or surroundings. And apparently aru ni arazu is like, is not, very emphatic. And cho ka, I looked that up, and cho is kind of, it's straight, but it also like is honest. It's like, you know, clear cut. And then down is like down or below. So that's where Shohaku Okamura says that's right beneath, right under our feet. But literally it's straight down, just directly below. And he says within a single drop of water, and I guess that makes sense. But he says it's not just one's surroundings that are like this. Similarly, directly below and a drop of water. So, Dogen is pointing out, and I will, is it okay for Zoom folks if I stop share and just pull up the PDF if you want to view it? Okay. So Dogen's pointing out how profoundly limited our perceptions are, right? If you just contemplate this metaphor of oceans, we have this experience of an ocean, right? If we were to go to the coast and maybe we were going to go on a boat and, you know, go whale watching or something, you know, the ocean is the surface of the ocean, and its appearance as we see it meet the horizon, and it's maybe waves and what have you. But we know, you know, the ocean is vast, incredibly many different creatures living in it, large and small. You know, what is an ocean to a whale? What is an ocean to a starfish? What is an ocean to a creature that lives down in the deepest trench? What is the ocean viewed from outer space, as I say? What is the ocean when we're talking about molecules or tides or the vast currents that, you know, control our climate and weather? Think about the ocean in three dimensions, undersea volcanoes, deep parts, shallow parts. Think about the ocean and cloud formation, evaporating water and the formation of clouds, which then comes over the land. Waves and shores, boundaries. In a sense, there's only one ocean, right? We just kind of arbitrarily name different sections. And then, you know, we think about it, you can also think, what about in this class? This very group of people right now, right? We have a sense like, yeah, I'm in a Buddhist class, okay? We have our perceptions of that. There's some people who are in the cloud, people in the dirt zendo, and I'm talking and we're learning about Buddhism. But there's, you know, there's so much going on here that we're not even paying attention to or is outside of our sphere of awareness. What's going on in each person's mind and body, all the different conditions that are present in the different cloud zendo locations where people are from, people's different perspectives, understanding as they hear, or their level of engagement or curiosity or reaction to it, attitude, different experiences of people with pain, worry or stress. And then there's all that crazy stuff happening inside our bodies, our lungs breathing the air, liver filtering our blood, our stomach digesting our meal. All of that, you know, that's all going, it's incredible. It's just mind-boggling. No one of us will ever appreciate the depth of what's even just happening inside our bodies. Then there's this group's position in the transmission of the Dharma, or, you know, how are we passing these concepts down from a long past? And how do we compare to other groups who are studying this? There's our positions in the world. There's in this room and in all the rooms where those in the cloud are as well, there's insects, bacteria, microbes, molecules, air. Our perceptions of situations in the world can be like this as well. And I was hoping that tonight would spark some discussions about that. Whether we're talking about like our perceptions of maybe a problem in family relationships or an issue at work, or it's a, you know, in Portland right now, for instance, we have a really bad homeless problem. There's, you know, and there's, I think all of us try to form some opinions about that, to try to figure it out. Why is this happening? And maybe what should happen in order to fix it? And, you know, our attitudes about what's acceptable and what's not, and all of this. And yet, like, no, if any one of us really went to go try to fix it, like the closer we got to that situation, the more complicated everything would seem, right? We'd just be like, oh, no wonder this seems like such an intractable problem, right? Like, it would just as if we were diving into the ocean and exploring the nooks and crannies. There's so much there, and almost all of our misunderstandings between human beings are like, you know, I have a perception of you, and I have an idea of why you're acting the way you are, and yet that's just a, you know, that's just a perception. And even if there's some aspects of it which are true, it cannot be the whole picture, right? It's impossible for it to be the whole picture. So Dogen is asking us to really realize and contemplate the shocking limits on our perceptions and understanding. But why? Is it only to teach us humility? Which wouldn't be a bad thing, right? That, you know, that's something. But, you know, contemplating this too much could also shut us down and make us give up. I mean, if our perceptions are so limited and I can't possibly understand what's going on in your head or what's really going on in this situation, everything's always more complicated. Like, you know, it can make you just kind of figure, well, if everything is so limited, even if even our insights are limited, why bother? And if it's all relative and nothing is ultimately true, then why not just enjoy one's life and give up trying to figure anything out? And how can we possibly be effective if there's just so much beyond our awareness? So as I mentioned earlier, Dogen will get to answering part of this in next week's passage about fish and birds. But in this week's passage, we can see that he says, before we really get the Dharma, we think we pretty well understand everything. I mean, everything that matters anyway, right? Like, we know what we need to know. Yeah, there might be some stuff that might be interesting to know more about, but we know what we need to know. But once our body mind is completely steeped in the Dharma, once we really wake up to what it means, we realize how much we don't know. But not in a way that makes us feel flawed or bad, just in a way that seems inevitable and natural. In this dusty world and beyond, one assumes many situations. Is realizing one's insight reaches only so far. It's most important that sometimes it's a cliche, right? It's most important to know what you don't know, right? That's actually the intelligent way to approach a situation, is really to have a sense of, like, so what Dogen is leading us to is a teaching that waking up to the reality of our natural insufficiency is an essential part of awakening. And then we wake up to a world which is ironically perfectly sufficient. So that's the fun of next week's passage, of how, like, even though the fish can't leave the water, and if its range is small, you know, it just stays in one area, but if it's completely there, it manifests the whole of the Dharma. So more on that next week, but this week, waking up to what we don't know, to the limits of perceptions. So another way of thinking about Zen practice is letting go of attachment to all views. All of them. And views are basically, you know, the mental constructs we've created, our conclusions about a situation based on our perceptions and understanding and, you know, all the information that we have up until this point. Now, when we talk about, like, letting go of views or attachment to views, we're not talking about getting rid of views. You can't live without views. You can't even be without views. That's just the way our brains work. But we can recognize them as views, right? As instead of inherent truth. So for instance, you could use when you're out on the ocean and somebody, you know, somebody said, you know, don't you realize how many other aspects of the ocean there are? I mean, you could still just, like, yeah, well, it looks like a circle and I'm just going to be coasting along the waves here, right? You're still going to function based on your perceptions, but you don't necessarily have to think, like, you know, which we don't in the ocean, but in our lives, we don't have to think, like, this is the way things are. This is the only way things are, and I see it all. So I don't think we have, I don't know. I guess we could take a little vote. Because I have a couple more things to say, but it certainly won't take up 20 minutes. But one of the things I wanted to ask you, and it might just be easier in small groups. Can you think of a time when your perception, perspective, or view of someone, or yourself, or a situation changed radically? It might just be worthwhile to just leave a minute of silence to think about this, because and this can happen in practice. This can be, you know, practice insights that we've gotten on the cushion or off, or of course it can be insights that we get. And an insight meaning essentially here, right, like a recognition of what you have not previously perceived, or a limitation in your understanding. So I'll just leave a minute. Let us reflect. So I'll start by sharing one. I'm sure there's lots of different examples I could think of, but I don't know. Let's see. I changed my mind about which one I was gonna share. So I guess one of the cooler ones was I was in a retreat, and I don't know, I was struggling and felt my practice was inadequate. I really longed to realize all this cool stuff that the teachers and the ancestors were talking about, but none of it seemed anywhere near me. And my teacher gave a talk on like one or more of the Dharma ancestors. And somehow, you know, and you'll probably find this with my teaching as well, like you remember you took something away from it. You can't even really remember what I said, right? I don't know. But what she managed to get across to me was like the Dharma ancestors were just like you. And somehow for the first time I was able to like perceive myself as the same kind of creature as the Dharma ancestors, that perception of myself that, I don't know, I was just small and inadequate. I guess, you know, I recognize that that was just a perception I was carrying, and that what the teaching was saying was like, eh, get rid of that. anyone else willing to share? And when you realized how little you actually had understood. Jimmy.
Did you say me?
Yeah.
You know, when you just started talking about, when you said, I don't know if you ever said that before, but I'm currently reading Women of the Way. Mm-hmm. And for those of you who don't know, Sally G. Coe Tisdale wrote that, and it's about the women, teachers and ancestors that we chant on Sunday morning. And she has a story for each. based in history as much as there is history to understand. And that's what I'm coming away with, is that exact same phrase. These women were just like me. If I can normalize today's current events against the history and the events of the times in which they lived, the obstacles that we face are not that unlike, not that different. So that was a big realization for me, and really comforting. Very comforting.
Thank you. I know it can be hard enough even to think of something like this. Maybe you'll think about it tomorrow. It'll come to your mind tomorrow.
I think my changes in this happen really gradually. Mm. It's hard for me to think of something that has happened suddenly.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't think it has to be sudden. Yeah. I mean, basically recognizing, like, you know, at this point, you realize this, and way back when, pretty clueless. It's a lot of stuff like that. And human beings are just, it's like they live to point out our limited perceptions to us, right? So the other example I was thinking for myself was at the Zen Center where I trained, I was in charge of the, like the ceremonies and altars for a period of time. And there was a woman who, I don't know, it was almost like she was mentoring with me, and she was going to be doing most of it. And I was just kind of, we're just going to make sure that, you know, she knew what she needed to know and had what she needed. And I don't know, somehow, like, in my drive for efficiency, like, you know, had kind of sent her off to do her thing. And it turned out she was upset with me, and she actually had the guts to come and tell me that. And she was talking about how, from her perspective, like, she had taken this job in order to be mentored by me, in order to be with me, in order, like, I mattered. I was part of the deal. And I was, oh, like, somebody cares that I'm the, like, I almost previously would think of myself as just, you know, I'm doing this function. And as long as somebody else can come along and fill that function, it doesn't matter that it's me. So that was always a real turning point where I have to remember, yes, sometimes it does matter to people that it's you. Anything else out there? Marv.
I have something to offer. I hope it's apropos of Dogen excerpts. Last May, I found out that my daughter-in-law had broken up my son's marriage. And I found out from her reasons, which to me bordered on the psychotic. But instead of resenting her, you know, because she was very sort of open about her reasons, it occurred to me as a kind of general rule that people do the best they know how. Everybody is deluded in some way. So nobody is doing great things all the time. People do awful things, including our bugaboo of the year, Putin. And you could choose anybody. He's doing the best he knows how. He's just really, really deluded. I think this helps avoid resentment and feel compassion, even for people who are screwing things up royally. And I think that fits with Dogen because everybody's perceptions are different.
Yep. Yeah, and you could even elaborate from that, like the I find the Buddhist teaching of the six realms really instructive for this kind of thing. Because sometimes you can't, like, it's difficult to know what you don't know, right? It's tricky to study that. So that's where actually like perspective taking or explorations of other ways can help you realize, oh, I never thought it could be approached that way. And in the six realms, you know, there's like the fighting demigods in one realm who are just, they're not that bad off, but they just want more and they resent the people who have more. And so they're just competitive, right? Then there's the beast realm where basically beings, that's all they care about is to eat, sleep, have sex. That's it. And it's a kind of fog of just base self-interest. So you can sometimes appreciate that like there's so many different ways to experience this world. And what looks, you know, crazy to us from the perspective of a hell being might make sense in a way. So of course, the ultimate perception shift that we want to cultivate is that shift away from a sense of, you know, inherent self. And this letting go of all views is something that we can do in Zazen and at other times, but especially in Zazen. And we're not like getting rid of them, but letting them go in the sense that we're not holding on to them. We're not trying to maintain them at the moment in Zazen. And as views start to float away, this really exposes the emptiness of self. In some senses, this sense of self is just constructed of views. So, and this can get more and more and more and more subtle over the course of practice. So at first, it really may be that we sit down and we have to really work through our karma and our relationships with people and our, you know, low self-esteem or our struggle with anxiety or depression or something. And there's a lot of stuff to kind of just let be. But even when some of that has, you know, died down a little bit, it isn't so pressing, there's just an incredible number of views that you are holding while you sit. It's just an infinite pile of views that can get more and more and more subtle. And if you ever have the opportunity to sit a long meditation retreat, it's possible after a number of days, it's like, you know, the brain kind of exhausts itself. And then the views about all that stuff, you know, why are you still thinking about it? So I can die down a little bit, not be as compelling anyway. But then even when you're just kind of spacious and you're just sitting there, and then you got this view like, I'm sitting here. And then you have this view of like, well, I want to let go of this sense of self. And then there's an I who wants to let go of a sense of self. And there's like, it's just, the views can be subtle, but they're very, very pervasive. So sometimes I like to think of it as my mind is trying to hold the universe together. And when I'm sitting Zazen, I try to encourage my mind, like remind my mind, like, you know, you're not actually holding it together. If for this moment You let go of your name, you let go of your sense as a woman, you let go of your sense as a Zen practitioner, you just let go of your sense as a human being, you let go of what's right and what's wrong. You know, that's why Dogen lists in Fukan Zazengi, right? Let go of right and wrong, let go of intellect and all that. And he's not saying, you know, try to keep the mind free of thoughts, because, you know, they come up. We're letting go of our agendas, right? Letting go of the views. I'll leave it there. We have a few minutes if anybody has a closing question or statement. I'm sure you guys are just gonna wander away going, oh yeah, now I get it. Dave.
I mean, a thought kept arising to me. I don't know if this is direct Van Point or not, but since we're going soon, I can just get it out there. It's contained within your head is a lifetime of experiences and just a chaos, a cloud of conflicting thoughts and impulses and emotions. And that, I think, forms a sea. And those parts of it that you can see, that's just you. Like that you are that circle. And there's all this stuff.
Interesting.
But when you say I in any given moment, you say, well, this is as far as I can see in this thing.
And yet, it's so true. And we have seemed to have no problem. We just assemble an I at any moment, right? Like I. But when you really think, what is that? What is the I? You know, is the I still there when you're asleep? Is the I still there when you're unconscious? Is the I still going to be there if you get dementia? Is the hand an I? I mean, is that part of you? I guess it's part of you, but if you cut it off, you'd still be I. I don't know, like, let alone all the subconscious stuff and the fact that, you know, as modern psychology is showing, our conscious narrative is just kind of comes after the fact to explain what's happening. So what are we, right? but yeah, I kind of like that, you know, we can still use the I. We're just, you know, making a call on a limited perception at any given moment. And that's also why, you know, the idea that we don't, that you know, it's infinite what we don't know and our view is limited, is no excuse for not being taking action and speaking, and because that is our gift, and that is the only thing that we can do. So I like to think of the precept, do not be mean with dharma or wealth, share understanding, give freely of self. So especially if we don't have that sense of like inherent self and we're really worried about it and defensive about it, this can just be an offering. Like, well, from where I'm sitting, looks like this. From where I'm sitting, that doesn't look like a good thing and I'm gonna try to stop it. Well, then we're more lighthearted about it, right? Because we recognize we don't have the mastery of all knowledge. All right, well, that's it. we offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Damiao.